on Justice and Public Safety, the Subcommittee on Energy Defense Services, and the Innocent Inquiry Commission. The mission statement under which we are going to operate says the office, the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety Subcommittee shall study the Office of Energy Defense Services and determine whether changes should be made in the ways in which appropriate funds are used to provide legal assistance and representation to indigent persons, and the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission, and determine whether changes should be made to the way in which the Commission investigates and determines credible claims of factual innocence made by criminal defendants. And then, of course, we shall report our findings and recommendations to the full Joint Oversight Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety. Our strategy in which we are going to operate, our next meeting will be February 3rd at 1 o'clock. The following meeting will be February 10th at 10 o'clock. And then our recommendations will be sent up on March 10th for the full Oversight Committee. The presentations today are going to be made by Tom Mahar for North Carolina Office of Energy Defense Services. Lindsey Geis-Smith has a very good middle name, Geis, well-known, North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. Robert Sharp is going to talk to us about the Office of the Capital Defender. And then Chris Muma will talk to us about the Center on Actual Innocence. But before we do that, before we start our presentations, I want Jennifer Bergman to make a few statements. She's our legal counsel.
Sir, would you like me to stand up?
Yes,
there?
I would.
Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Bedford with the Legislative Analysis Division. This morning, I'm going to give you a very broad national historical context for the subjects that we're discussing. I know that there are people in this room that have far more expertise than I do, but just so that you have a context, initially discussing the right to counsel, many of you know the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution does, in fact, grant the right to counsel. Back all the way in 1853, state courts in Indiana found that the indigent who could not afford to pay for a private lawyer should still have proper representation. The court wrote even then that it's grounded in the principles of a civilized society, not necessarily constitutional or statutorily. It's not to be thought of in a civilized community for a moment that any citizen put in jeopardy of life or liberty should be debarred of counsel because he is too poor to employ such aid. Our U.S. Supreme Court examined in 1938 a Depression-era case. It was a capital case, and the Supreme Court found in what is commonly called the Scottsboro case that you do, in fact, even if you're indigent and you're facing capital crime, that you deserve the state to provide counsel. Over the next 30 years, the U.S. Supreme Court continued to expand that. In Betts v. Brady, the court found not only should indigents get counsel in capital crimes, but also what they considered serious non-capital crimes. It was further expanded that in Gideon v. Wainwright that an indigent person accused of any felony deserved the appointment at the expense of the state of counsel. It was expanded to children and juvenile proceedings. It was expanded to misdemeanors in the event that there's a potential of loss of liberty. And the court continued to extend the right to counsel and specifically the right to the state providing counsel in post-arrest interrogations, lineups, other identification procedures, preliminary hearings, arraignments, and then further plea negotiations and post-conviction. Sentencing proceedings and appeals, as well as some probation and parole proceedings, have been shown by the U.S. Supreme Court to deserve an extension of the right of counsel, even to indigents. Throughout history, as the right has extended, it has been placing stress on policymakers to create systematic ways to deliver this constitutionally required defense service to all of the indigents, and to provide competent, vigorous legal representation. The national scene saw the creation of indigent defense services in larger cities in New York and Los Angeles, and now, of course, nationwide, including our own state, North Carolina, indigent defense services. Examining the history of forensic technology, DNA, which we are now very familiar with, actually only came on the scene as early as 1985. In the beginning, juries and law enforcement did not find it credible. And now that time has passed and we have found that genetic material found at a crime scene could actually point us in the direction of a potential perpetrator with better than 99% accuracy, it is much more popular. In fact, law enforcement agencies around the world are assembling DNA bases and databases. And the FBI now has over 5 million convicted offenders and sex offenders in their database. It's not just the police and prosecutors who have embraced DNA. We've also found that DNA has led to the innocence commissions as well as exonerations. Some causes for wrongful conviction are listed as eyewitness misidentification, improper forensics, false confessions or admissions, as well as the use of informants or snitches that are not truthful. Nationally, the Innocence Project started in New York, related to the Cordoza School of Law at the Yeshiva University in 1992. They were an independent nonprofit organization, and to date, they are listing 337 people nationally that have been exonerated specifically from DNA testing. Our own Innocence Commission was brought about from legislation from 2006 and created in 2007. That sort of gives you a history of where we are in indigent defense services as well as where we are in innocence inquiry. Thank you.
Our first presenter will be Tom Maher. Tom, will you come forward, please? Mr. Maher is the Executive Director of the Office of Energy Defense Services and has held that role for
7 years.
Usually when a marriage lasts 7 years, it gets rocky right there for a second.
7 years.
Yeah. 7 years. Fortunately, my wife has forgotten our seventh year. Okay. Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to address this subcommittee as you begin the work on these important questions. And I understand, of course, this afternoon there are time limitations. If any member of the subcommittee would like us to ever visit and answer further questions or come to Durham and see how we operate, you're certainly welcome to do that. Today I'm going to cover a number of topics. One is just a basic overview of the Office of Indigent Defense Services, talk some about how IDS has succeeded in meeting its statutory mission, give an overview of our budget, and then talk briefly about the future of IDS. IDS has now been in operation for about 15 years, and so it's actually a good time, I think, to talk about why IDS was created, the functions it serves, and why it should continue. For some of you, I'm sure, already aware of this, but back in 1998, the General Assembly created a study commission to look at how indigent defense was being handled. And the study commission had a number of meetings, got information from a number of sources, and then in May of 2000 issued its report and recommendation. And the report and recommendation basically led to the creation of the Office of Indigent Defense Services. There were some key findings behind the studies commission's recommendation that there be an independent agency on this. At the time, basically, AOC, which was responsible for handling indigent defense, lacked the centralized authority that was required for the needed coordinated planning, oversight, or management. So what happened is there was significant growth in costs that were outstripping the growth in caseloads. That was true generally. It was specifically true in capital cases where there was, according to the study commission, an over 300% increase in cost during that time. There were no statewide uniform standards for the appointment, qualifications, compensation, or performance of counsel. And the ability to do the required management was hampered because they didn't have the data, the statistics needed to analyze what was going on. And then, as another very fundamental issue, they lacked the independence that's really important for a defense agency. Public defenders, private lawyers are doing defense work. Part of their role is to oppose the state in court for cases. It is a constitutional requirement that the individual lawyers be able to act with independence. And that is why it is recommended that the agency that's responsible for the defense be independent of judges in the court system. So the Studies Commission recommendation recommended that the General Assembly create an Office of Indigent Defense Services, that office be given the authority and responsibility to manage the resources necessary to provide high-quality legal representation in the most cost-effective manner possible. And so that's basically what led to the passage of the Indigent Defense Services Act. And that act puts forth a number of related missions. IDS exists to enhance oversight of the services, to improve the quality and enhance independence of counsel, to establish uniform policies, to generate reliable data. And then the final one, which I always think of as kind of encapsulating everything we do, is to deliver services in the most efficient and cost-effective manner without sacrificing quality. The General Assembly specifically created IDS as an independent agency. IDS was created within the judicial branch, but was an independent agency. And we're overseen by a 13-member commission. And our commission, I think it's important to keep in mind, is very different than the Innocence Inquiry Commission. We have 13 members on our commission. They're appointed by a variety of stakeholders, Chief Justice, the Governor, the House, the Senate, State Bar Association, Advocates for Justice, a number of groups appoint, and then the commission itself has three appointees, and they are very actively involved in managing how IDS operates. They make the appointment of the director. They appoint the capital defender. They appoint the appellate defender. They are the ultimate authority for policies and procedures. They meet quarterly, and I can tell you, and certainly anyone who's interested should attend a meeting, they are very active commissioners and take a very strong oversight role in how IDS operates. IDS, up until last year, specifically exercised its powers independently of the Administrative Office of the Courts, and the Administrative Office of the Courts had no power over IDS's budget. We worked with AOC. AOC provides us important tech support, HR support, purchasing. We certainly coordinate with them, but our budget is separate and the commission was separate.
Would you mind if we ask questions?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
The 13-member commission, you say, mm-hmm. meets quarterly. Who are they? And how, I mean, you say that the speaker.
Yeah, we have the Chief Justice appoints, and the Chief Justice appointment, I believe, is to be an active or retired member of the judiciary. Right. Yes, I have somebody here making sure. The governor appoints a non-lawyer. The General Assembly appoints two, one on the recommendation of the President Pro Tem of the Senate, one recommendation of the Speaker of the House. Chris Mumma, who you'll be hearing from later, is the Senate's appointee to the commission. The North Carolina State Bar appoints, the North Carolina Bar Association appoints, the Advocates for Justice have an appointment, the Public Defender Association, we have the Burt Kemp, who's the this year's head of the Public Defender Association, is here and a chief public defender. The Black Lawyers Association has one appointment, and the Women's Lawyers Association has an appointment. Then the remaining three are appointed by the commission itself. Commissioners serve for a four-year term. They're subject to an appointment for a second four-year term, and then they've are unable to be appointed after that.
Thank
you. Okay. And I will say, in addition to the quarterly meetings, we have committees that tackle specific issues. There's a capital committee. There's a committee that deals with contracts because we've developed a new contract system. And those committees meet on a regular basis as needed, so it's not simply a quarterly basis.
The commission meet to go over the money in any way? Or
yes. One of the important things we do, Elisa Wolper, who's our chief financial officer, is here. We have regular presentations on what the budget is, how our current spending is going. So, for example, in September, generally there's a pretty in-depth review of what we expect for the rest of the fiscal year. Before we make budget requests, you know, we certainly run it by the commission. So they're very involved in understanding the resources we have and how those resources are being used and what requests we're making. Okay. Last session, obviously changes were made. One of the directives led to the formation of this subcommittee to study the future of IDS, but there were also some other specific directions. IDS was transferred, so it now reads that we are created within the Administrative Office of the Courts, and the AOC was required to do an annual audit of our budget. I will say they were not provided any resources. We've been meeting with AOC and talking about how to accomplish that. Both the House and Senate budgets maintained the essential independence of IDS, although the transfer within AOC. The final budget changed that so that now the AOC director has the power to modify the IDS budget or use IDS funds without the consent of IDS commission or office. These were changes that were not, as I understand, supported by either the Chief Justice or the Administrative Office of the Courts. Okay. One of the things I think when people talk about public defenders or indigent defense, what comes to mind is a typical adult criminal case that you would see in TV or whatever, and that's certainly a huge amount of what we do, but what IDS covers is actually much more complex than that. We do juvenile delinquency proceedings. We represent parents in abuse, neglect, and dependency or termination of parental rights cases. We do commitment and guardianship cases, appeals, post-conviction. We have a contract with Prisoners Legal Services to provide meaningful access to the courts for inmates, and then a number of other things, jails, things of that nature. So there's a whole lot of different case types, some of which have very different needs in terms of how the services are provided. This is a map some of you may have seen before. It was actually created by fiscal staff, and I appreciate that. That gives you a general sense of how our services are delivered. We have 16 local public defender offices. They cover a total of 17 districts and 31 counties. And those public defender districts are noted by the colored counties. So each of those that has a color has a public defender operating. The counties that have the hash marks in them basically are ones where we have gone in pursuant to the General Assembly's directive and entered into large-scale contracts. Those large-scale contracts cover adult criminal cases in those counties. We also, the remainder of the counties, have private assigned counsel working off of rosters. We have contracts for various specialties in some counties, and we use some nonprofits. So, for example, in Charlotte, there's a nonprofit that provides delinquency representation. The local public defender offices, as I mentioned, we have 16 of those offices. I think we have a few of the chiefs here from there. They employ about 276 assistant public defenders who work full-time providing these representation. They're supported by investigators and other support staff. Charlotte, we're fortunate that the county funds some grant-funded positions. And they have, in the last fiscal year, resolved about 102,000 cases. And we count dispositions, meaning all charges that are resolved together at the same time in front of the same judge is a disposition. So that's what that's reflecting. And the overall public defender budget is about a little over $37 million. We have statewide defenders, and you'll be hearing from Mr. Sharp about the Capital Defender's Office, so I won't go through that in any detail, but they basically handle a number of the potentially capital and capital cases. We have the Office of the Appellate Defender. I think I see Glenn Girding here, who's relatively new appellate defender, and they provide direct representation on appeals and manage the rosters. We have the Office of Special Counsel provide specialized representation in those courts. We have the bulk of the work is still done by what we call PAC, the privately assigned counsel. They tend to be on local rosters administered by indigent appointment committees in the county or district level. They are appointed by the case. They are paid by the hour. We have had back in 2011, we reduced the hourly rates. So the hourly rates you see there are the current hourly rates, ranging from $55 an hour for misdemeanors up to $85 for a capital case for first-degree murder. And, of course, for non-lawyers, you hear $55 an hour, and you think, well, I'd like to make $55 an hour. But, of course, these are private lawyers. They pay their office overhead, their rent, their insurance, all sorts of expenses. So by the time they're done paying overhead, the $55 an hour has very little left to make a living with. We do have, and we work with local actors to provide representation under other bases. So, for example, there are counties which do child support contempt or probation violations by a session, and we'll provide a lawyer or two lawyers for that session, and they're paid for the session as opposed to by the case. We have flat fees for district court cases in Rowan and Cabarrus. Those existed before IDS was created, and we've continued to work with those districts on those systems. We have now fairly large-scale contracts. The contracts, in essence, bundle a caseload and pay the lawyers a set amount for that caseload over the course of a year. We monitor the cases as they get them. We monitor their dispositions. They're paid the amount, basically in 12 equal payments. For cases that are truly extraordinary, something that you can't handle under the contract, there's the ability to get additional compensation for those cases. And we have two regional defenders who are out in the field making sure the lawyers are doing their work, responding to complaints from judges or clients, arranging training, helping the lawyers do the work so that we make sure that the money is well spent and the representation is good. And we currently have about 200 attorneys under contract in those 18 counties. We have always had contracts, not these large scale, and those continue, such as I mentioned, the contract with Prisoners Legal Services and others. And some in smaller counties, sometimes we've gone to contracts for delinquency work or parent representation at the request of local actors when the roster system wasn't working. Now, in some respects, it sounds like we have a very complex system. We have a number of different caseloads. We have a number of different delivery systems. And ultimately, that's a good thing because the system is complex. There aren't cookie-cutter cases. And just like the American Bar Association recommends that there be a mix, North Carolina reflects that, and I think North Carolina reflects why that's a good thing. Public defenders bring strengths, but they also have challenges. Same with the private assigned counsel and the contracts. The nice thing about having a mix is that the mix can fit the district. So, for example, Mecklenburg or Wake County, which have very large case going through the court system, support a public defender and get a lot out of the public defender. You go to a smaller county, Lenoir County or Martin County, it doesn't necessarily make economic sense to put a public defender there. It makes more sense to work with the local lawyers and use their advantages. Even in a public defender district, they can't handle every case. They have conflicts. They have overflows, and so we need to take advantage of the private lawyers to work on that. So the mix has actually worked well. It does make it more complex, but it allows flexibility and allows us to work with each district or county on their delivery system. We believe, I realize I'm biased, but I believe that we have been effective in meeting the mission. And the mission really is a combination of good management of the money and quality of representation. And as you can see, the cost per disposition has gone up very modestly since IDS has begun operations. And some of that, quite frankly, is because we have very low rates for the lawyers. We have stagnating public defender salaries. So I think at some point those need to be restored. But on a per case disposition, it has been managed very well. The growth rate that led to the creation of IDS has been greatly modified. And so on the balancing of the finances, I believe IDS has done an effective job. We provide fiscal oversight through billing. When I was practicing before IDS existed, there were no standard hourly rates. The judge would decide how much to pay you. We now have auditing to make sure that there aren't duplicate payments. We have deadlines to make sure fee applications are brought in on time. We analyze the data to see the trends and what's happening. We have put in numerous controls in the potentially capital cases because they're the ones that can become expensive. We work with the local actors. If they want to do a per session work, we'll find a way to try to do that. And of course, we've created this contract system, and one of the benefits of the contract system is it has, in fact, saved money in providing representation for adult criminal cases. One of the concerns I've heard in talking to legislators, and I understand the concern, is the fact that our budget is somewhat reactive. And how do we predict what we need? Because we have to pay for the cases. We can't turn cases away. And, of course, under an hourly system, there's this concern that how can we predict the hours? If you look historically, I think IDS has done a good job at the difficult task of predicting what the needs are. As I mentioned, in September, which is the end of the first quarter of the fiscal year, we do a presentation to the commission predicting what the next three quarters will look like. And we tend to predict with the recognition that caseloads may be higher than we'd expect, so we tend to be conservative. And if you look over a seven-year period, we have been less than 3% off in predicting what those costs are. And given the variety of drivers for our costs, I think that's a remarkable achievement. And, of course, on the flip side, it's not a drive just to be as cost-effective as possible. It's to be cost-effective without sacrificing quality representation. So we have worked with other groups, the school of government in particular, but others, so that there's now manuals for lawyers. There's performance guidelines. There's checklists to help busy lawyers make sure they're doing their job right. We've got brief banks. We've got transcripts available. The school of government does a trial school for lawyers who are new to get trial skills. They do a misdemeanor, a number of specialized trainings that allow the lawyers to quickly develop the skills that are needed to actually go into court and start providing representation. We have other resources. We have a juvenile defender to make sure that juvenile defense work is done with high quality. Since I've been here, we've developed a forensic resource council. It was actually one person working part-time, and her job is to help lawyers deal with all the scientific evidence. We've heard about the development of DNA briefly in the introduction. There's a host of forensic scientific evidence that's vitally important, which most lawyers would be incredibly inefficient to try to learn on their own or to master on their own, so we have one person who helps them do that. As I mentioned, we have regional defenders in the contract counties. We have a public defender administrator. So for all 16 public defender offices, we have one person whose job it is to help them get the most out of their offices. And we have a research department, which makes it sound large. It's actually two people. But we're able to do fairly sophisticated analysis of the data to understand what we're doing and what works and what isn't working. Now, one of the things we wanted to do recently was find out from the judges who are out there in court, in district court and superior court, they're seeing the representation, they're dealing with IDS, get feedback from them. So we asked the school of government to conduct a survey, and they recently conducted a survey, and they're in the process of working on a report, which will make the results a bit more manageable. But a number of questions, I think, are important. This chart reflects, we had like 135 judges respond, which is a very high response rate. And we asked, first, one question was what their overall satisfaction was with IDS administration in potentially capital cases. And as you can see, the overwhelming majority were either satisfied or very dissatisfied, satisfied with the work we do. And similarly, for the non-capital representation, the judges were either satisfied or very satisfied by a large percentage in terms of what IDS is doing. There was an audit that was done recently that looked at, it was by the state auditor, a performance audit, that looked at how well IDS was implementing its own policies in capital cases. Were we appointing the right number of cases, lawyers? Were we paying the lawyers correctly? And as you can see, that the audit found that IDS was doing a remarkable job in enforcing its policies. Our budget, where the money comes from, very big overview. This is for fiscal year 15. The appropriations was about $111 million. Our budgeted recoupment receipts was about $10 million, and what happens for the recoupment is a client, a defendant who's found guilty, judge has the authority to order that they repay the value of services. They either repay it while they're on probation, or it may become a civil judgment that we collect, and it's a significant portion of our budget on that. We have some miscellaneous receipts, and so the total is about $122 million. In terms of where that money goes, this is a very basic breakdown of where the money goes. As you can see, almost half of it goes to the private assigned counsel rosters. Then we have contracts and other support. The defender's office get slightly more than a third of the budget, and that's the basic breakdown of how the money is spent. We have provided a series of kind of pie charts just to give you a little bit more in depth. And the large pie chart on the left is our overall budget, and then we break down on the right how that breaks down. So, for example, in the local public defender offices, you can see that the majority of the money, about 72%, is spent paying the lawyers to be in court doing the work. 22% is for support personnel. The other operating costs are fairly modest percentages. Statewide defender programs. We have, as I said, the capital defender, the appellate defender, special counsel, and you'll see the breakdown of that. And once again, the vast majority of the money is going to provide pay for the lawyers who are doing the work, who are in court, representing clients, or the needed support for them. PAC rosters. When you look at how the money is spent for PAC, a significant portion of that is spent in district court. It's the cases are smaller. They're obviously less expensive, but the volume of cases is in district court. Then we've got adult superior court, and that between the two of them take up about three quarters, and then the remainder are much smaller percentages. Our contracts, yes.
The last two pages you've shown us, the left pie charts, have several things called just category names. Something apparently didn't come out right. Can we get updated copies of those?
Yes.
Go back up to
the first page you showed the pie charts and the ones.
Private counsel under contract. That's got one. If you go to the next one, it's got several.
Yeah, mine, we can get you updated. For some reason, the ones I have, yes.
I'm sorry, this is Danielle Carmen, IDS. For some reason, when we emailed them, I was just noticing that they all went wonky. That's my technical term. So we will change them into PDFs and email them directly to fiscal staff so that they are not, those categories can't move around. My sincere apologies.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't realize, because my printout actually hit. Yeah. Okay, we will fix that. Thank you. And you'll get fixed ones for all of those that will show the breakdowns of how money is spent for these various means, including the private assigned counsel. I see what you're saying. And our administration. Our total administrative budget is about 2%, and then the pie chart shows where that money is being spent for the administration. And I apologize that those are not properly. As those of you who've served on JPS and dealt with our budget, you know we've had issues of underfunding. We've often had carry-forward debt. Last year, I think our carry-forward debt was in the neighborhood of $6 million, which means that out of this year's budget, the first thing we do is pay off the private lawyers who didn't get paid for that. Our expectation at this point is that we will have reduced that somewhat by the end of this year, but there'll still be some carry-forward debt. And this chart demonstrates kind of the history of that. There have been years, you know, where we have paid the current year's demand with the current year's budget, but because we have been paying off prior year's debt, we continue with carry-forward debt. Okay, what does drive our costs? Well, as you can see, that the cost per case has not gone up dramatically since IDS came into existence. And so the real cost driver is the volume of cases and the type of cases. As caseloads go up, either because the caseload for the whole court system goes up, or as shown on this slide, we get a larger share of the pie, then our costs go up, even though the average costs haven't changed dramatically. If we see a...
Yes. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm looking at what drives IDS cost, I'm looking at the difference between 2001 and 2014. During that time period, the cost of disposing of the case stayed about the same, but didn't we continue to drop the private assigned counsel rate at the time? I don't know exactly when it changed from $75 down to $55 down to...
Yes, it changed in 2011.
Okay.
And so the 2014, had those rates not gone down, the 2014 number would be higher.
Significantly, I don't know how much higher that would have been.
We could probably figure that out because, yes, Lisa Wolpert's here. She's our chief financial officer.
That reduction in rates probably reduced what our spending is today by about $18 million.
Okay. And percentage-wise per case, you think what, 20%, 30%?
For example, there was a $5 drop for serious felonies, but a $20 drop for district court cases on that. And as you can see, if you look at the number of filings, the percentage that are receiving court-appointed counsel has gone up. So even if the court system as a whole may not be handling more cases or they may even see a drop, when our share of the pie goes up for us, our caseload has gone up. Okay, there have been funding cuts, obviously, and in 2011, we, as commented, we dropped the hourly rates. We recently did a survey of the Private Assigned Council to try to determine what impact that has had. Those reports are online. Needless to say, there has been a impact on the lawyers doing this work. Fewer and fewer lawyers are able to continue doing this. The $55 an hour, which is what covers a lot of cases, but even the higher rates are not sustainable, and it's starting to affect the quality of representation. The public defender's offices, while they didn't get the kind of cut the Private Assigned Council cut, have seen very little in the way of raises. Because of the way we're budgeted, we can't allow them to use their full allotments to begin with. And so we're also seeing, just as I think the district attorney's offices are probably seeing, that particularly for lawyers who kind of been there for a little while and have been gaining experience, that the lack of pay is affecting that. So the budget is beginning to affect the quality. And as I mentioned, the school of government did a survey of the judges, and one of the questions we asked judges was whether they were seeing the impact in court. They're the ones, you know, obviously seeing lawyers in court. And a majority of the district court and superior court judges reported that they had seen an impact on the quality that they attributed to the reductions in rates. Okay, the future for IDS. One of the things in terms of thinking about, okay, what should happen, what should be done with IDS, is to think about what the ultimate goal is. And if the ultimate goal is a healthy indigent defense system, I think it's worth talking briefly about what that means. And as you heard at the beginning, you know, there's a variety of decisions that recognize the right to counsel. Gideon versus Wainwright in 1963 is perhaps, you know, the kind of seminal case on that. And said very clearly that in our system, to have a fair trial, you need a lawyer. And so if you cannot afford a lawyer, the state needs to provide one. And, of course, just providing a lawyer without the lawyer having certain abilities doesn't provide a fair trial. And so a lawyer coming into court needs knowledge. They need to know the law. They need to know the procedures. They need some level of experience. Obviously, for minor misdemeanors, it's much less experience than for a capital case or serious felony. They need access to resources, including the time to work on the case, and support in some cases from other professionals, investigators in some cases, other experts and others, and they need to act independently. So if you're in court and what you see is that the counsel come to court knowing the law and the facts, they're prepared. They've met with their client before court, and so they've gotten their client prepared. They are there representing the best interests of the client, and they have the ability, the skill and experience to do it. And the clients come in and they trust their lawyers. They understand why they're there. They understand the charges. They understand their options. They've had the ability to think about the consequences. And they're prepared to go forward so that you've got everybody on the defense side prepared to take the advantage of the court system. On a systemic basis, when it works, the defense is part of the system. They're included in policy discussions. They provide management for their resources. They provide oversight for the defenders to make sure the defenders are trained and are doing a good job. They attract new lawyers to the system. This is a system that's going to keep on going. And they keep the competent counsel who've got the skills involved in their representation. To achieve those goals, there needs to be appropriate funding. Obviously, the people who come to work at public defenders' offices or take private assigned counsel cases are doing it with a large measure of public service and a recognition of the value of what they're doing, but there needs to be adequate funding for that. We believe that that is best achieved, administered by an agency that is directly accountable to the General Assembly and independent, and that has the authority working with local actors to implement the delivery systems that are needed on that. And we would hope and ask that there not be any further significant changes to IDS's independence or the delivery systems while the Chief Justice's Commission is conducting their study. And as I'm sure you all know, in addition to this body looking at the future of IDS, we've got the North Carolina Commission on the Administration of Law and Justice has a subcommittee on indigent defense that's meeting. They will not be issuing report or recommendation by March 10th. They will be doing it under a different timetable, and I would certainly hope that if there are going to be major changes, that at least be some thought to waiting until the Chief Justice's Commission has been able to provide some input on that as well. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions, Mr. Mayor? Yes, sir, Representative Jackson.
Director, I'm sorry. I want to call you Professor. Okay. I believe in 2013 we made a change to how Class 3 misdemeanors were sentenced.
Yes.
In order to realize the cost savings, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, the change so that if you had fewer than four prior convictions, it was a fine-only offense, and there'd be no right to court-appointed counsel for Class 3 misdemeanors.
And I believe there was a corresponding savings or cut to IDS.
Yes.
Do you remember that number?
$2 million.
Has there been any analysis done on whether that $2 million savings was actually realized in any way? Do your numbers between, I guess, 2013 and 2015 reflect cases or anything like
we
that?
We have looked at it. I will say, and Elisa Wolpert's here, and she may have more detailed information. For the first fiscal year, we would not have saved $2 million because the change didn't even occur until December 1st, and we were paying for cases that were appointed beforehand. Since then, we've seen a reduction in misdemeanors. I think there has been a cost savings. I don't know if Ms. Wolpert has a number she could give you today.
Ms. Wolpert, can you give us a number? Any further questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Director. Appreciate your presentation. A couple of quick questions on your map of how representation is provided.
Mm-hmm.
Wake and Pitt are showing shaded and hatched. Does that mean that you have both going
yes.
on?
Yes. The cases that the Public Defender's Office don't handle are handled by attorneys who are under contract.
And why would that not be the case for other large counties like Guilford and Versailles?
Well, when we got the directive to create the contract system, we began in the areas, quite frankly, that were close to us because it meant working with local folks. We rolled them out. We've been rolling east. Our plan would be, ultimately, we were directed to do it statewide. We certainly would be, if the General Assembly allows us to or directs us to, continue, and we would do it in the other counties. It takes time to develop a new system and switch over, and we've been doing it district by district.
Okay. When are you going to be up to the mountain, I wonder?
It's going to be a while. And I will say the very small rural counties are very hard to put under contracts because they're just not a predictable volume. We've had like Lenore and Green, it's been an issue. Wake's been much easier because we have a big enough volume which is easier to handle in the contract system. So we would go east and then head west.
Okay. Follow up or different question. You're discussing, part of what you were discussing is salaries of public defenders.
Yes.
Do you have, or is there some sort of analysis of public defenders' offices and salaries based on years of experience versus district attorneys? Because it seems to me that public defenders ought to be comparable to ADAs to some extent. Is there some sort of comparison that we can see?
Well, both are given the same allotment. In terms of what's actually spent, we're starting to look at that, but we don't have access, I think, to the DAs. We would need to coordinate with the district conference of DAs and try to do that. And I will caution that years of experience is clearly the way you would look at it. People may come into a PD's office with a great deal of private experience, and we would only see a few years of public experience. So the short answer is it's something we need to look at, but we don't have at this point.
Is it something that since you're all under AOC, couldn't AOC gather that? They'd have access to all of that, wouldn't they?
Can AOC do that?
I would.
Here's a button.
I apologize. I was with Chiefs of Staff, Marion Warren, Director of Administrative Office of Courts. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, sir. What was the question, sir?
The question was whether we could come up with a comparison of average public defender salaries and ADA salaries, taking them into account the years of experience for the people doing the work.
As to the average, yes. As to the number of years of experience it would take, the information coming in from culling from each side of the HR, but I believe it could be compiled.
I'd like that information, Mr. Chairman.
If that's possible, we would appreciate that information.
I think the PD may have
some
theirs right now.
This is a Burke Kemp.
If you don't mind, tell us who you are.
Yes, sir. This is Burke Kemp with the Fayette County Public Defender. I'm looking at a page 2 from the Fiscal Research Division, January 16, 2016, that has such a breakdown that I think you may be asking.
Yes, sir, but the breakdown is only based on averages and not by year of experience.
So we're going to keep taking that.
It's half your answers.
Correct. Are you three?
Absolutely.
Stevens.
Thank you. Are you meeting resistance to the contract provisions? I'm hearing lots of complaints.
Yes and
from
no.
Our district.
Yeah. So yeah. I think it depends on the district. There are places, and once again, the larger districts, it's worked more smoothly. There's been less resistance. Some districts, the smaller ones in particular, have resisted the change. In some cases, once the change has happened, they've adjusted to it. In some cases, they still resist it. So it really depends on a district-by-district basis. I will say, on average, when we put out a request for proposals, we get more responses than are needed. But that is not true everywhere, and for the serious felonies, where there's much more variation in a given case of how much time, I think the lawyers are much less willing to work under a contract system, even though we do have an extraordinary pay policy. So there is resistance in some areas and not in others.
Follow up. Because I've heard some people raise the question of, is this truly effective assistance of counsel if we're in essence trying to limit their time or limit what they're willing to be paid? If I can get by with 5 hours or 10 hours, where the case might really take 50, you know, is that
is a very serious concern. It is a serious concern, quite frankly, with flat fees. We have tried, and probably imperfectly, to address it in the contracts two ways. One, by bundling enough cases so that when you get the difficult case, you're getting enough other cases that you'll have the easier ones. And they report hours, and we track that. And secondly, to try to make readily available the ability in a truly extraordinary case to get extra pay. But it is a concern. I will say, because we have a research department, we are looking at outcomes by delivery systems. We're just getting some results because we want to see, have trial rates gone down? Because people may not be willing to trial case. Are they pleading their clients more often? And we're very concerned about that, and we're trying to look to see whether the data tells us what we're hearing anecdotally is true or not true, and if so, whether it's maybe not true for misdemeanors, but it is true for felonies. So that is a concern.
Follow up?
Yes, please. And one additional, again, maybe anecdotal, but people talking about having a contract rate, and then there's somebody coming in to watch and see if they've done what they're supposed to do, monitoring them in court, being paid $80,000 a year to monitor them while they're being paid less than $150 per case.
Yeah, we have two regional defenders. While there is a certain element of monitoring, I suspect what they would tell you is most of their time is trying to assist. So, for example, if a lawyer has a difficult case, they'll come in and help them plan the case or prepare for trial, provide them resources. The idea is not just to be a monitor, but to be a resource. But it is true that private lawyers working under the hourly rates or the contracts are struggling. I will say, and I've heard the same concerns about the contracts, and I think they're valid, and we tried to address them. 2 weeks ago, I got a call from a Superior Court judge in a non-contract district saying the exact same thing about, you know, people don't get paid enough hourly. In May and June, they don't get paid. And they were bringing in out-of-county attorneys for the felonies because they didn't have enough local folks. So I think it's an issue with contracts. It's an issue with below necessary pay, even when you pay hourly under that.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. Our next presenter will be Lindsay Guy Smith with the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission Overview.
That's very sad. Can it?
Good afternoon.
An HD panel, that's pretty clear. What that means. Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon, members of the subcommittee. I'm Lindsay Guy Smith. I'm the executive director of the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. I have been the director since October of 2015, so this is still very new to me, though I have been with the commission since January of 2010, so a little over 6 years. I want to thank all of you for asking us to come today and provide an overview of the commission, and I will be doing that, as well as providing a little bit of information on our budget and some of the needs of the commission. So the first question that we always get is, what is the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission? The commission is an independent state agency that was created by the General Assembly in 2006 and has been operating since 2007. The commission is a neutral, fact-finding agency that's charged with investigating and evaluating post-conviction claims of actual innocence. In that role as neutral investigator, we don't ever actually represent claimants. We just provide an impartial review of the claims. Pursuant to statute, our files are confidential and exempt from public records law, much like those of law enforcement. The commission was developed as an alternative to the adversarial post-conviction process, such as a motion for appropriate relief. Under its enabling statutes, the commission was given broad statutory authority to use all measures provided in Chapter 15A, which is the Criminal Procedures Act, and under the rules of civil procedure set out in 1A-1 to obtain information necessary to its inquiry. There have been some changes to the commission statute since its inception. Most notably in 2010 was the expiration of the sunset clause that the General Assembly had originally enacted. And also in 2012, some changes that gave the commission direct authority to obtain files and evidence from agencies, which freed up significant time and resources, increased efficiency, and assisted in developing additional working relationships between commission staff, law enforcement, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and clerk's offices statewide. Another question that we get asked is, what are our criteria for accepting a case for review? These are set out in the statute. The first is that the conviction must have been a North Carolina conviction. It must have been a felony conviction. The applicant must be living, and that's both at the time of application as well as throughout the commission's review. The applicant also must be claiming complete factual innocence of any criminal responsibility for the crime. So they can't be saying that they're claiming self-defense or that they, you know, drove the getaway car or something like that. They have to be claiming complete factual innocence. There must also be credible and verifiable evidence of innocence that exists, and there must be new evidence of innocence that the jury didn't hear at trial, that wasn't available at the time of plea, or that hasn't been heard in a post-conviction MAR hearing.
Sure.
An MAR is a motion for appropriate relief that is done after a conviction, and there are statutes within 15A that allow for that after conviction. Briefly, I'll go through a procedural overview of kind of how the commission works. This is very brief. First, the innocence claim must be initiated. That can be initiated by the defendant themselves, an attorney that's representing the defendant, a state or local agency, or by a court. And that is also statutorily prescribed. If a case meets the criteria that I just spoke about before, then the staff will screen and investigate the claim. This list that I'm going to give you is far from exhaustive, but includes things like reviewing files, searching for evidence, conducting interviews, and submitting evidence for DNA testing, among other things. If there is new, verifiable, credible evidence of innocence, then the commission staff presents the case to its 8-member commission. If the commission finds the statutory standard of sufficient evidence of factual innocence to merit further judicial review, then the case is referred to a 3-judge panel. If they do not find that the standard has been met, then the case is closed and there is no right to appeal. However, this does not impact the claimant's right to other post-conviction forms of relief, such as a motion for appropriate relief. The 3-judge panel is appointed by the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. This hearing is an adversarial hearing, so whereas before with the commission we were talking about everything kind of being neutral and fact-finding, this becomes an adversarial hearing again. The defendant is represented by counsel, and the state is represented by the district attorney's office, or in some limited circumstances by the attorney general's office. The burden of proof is on the defendant to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he or she is in fact innocent of the crimes for which he or she has been convicted. And the 3 judges must be unanimous in their decision to declare the person innocent. The commission itself is made up of 8 commissioners and 8 alternates. These are appointed on a rotating basis by the North Carolina Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court and the Chief Judge of the North Carolina Court of Appeals. These members represent different aspects of the criminal justice system, different perspectives, and also the public. They include a superior court judge who serves as the commission's chair, a district attorney, a defense attorney, a victim's advocate, a sheriff, a public member, and 2 discretionary members. Each commissioner serves a 3-year term and is limited to 2 consecutive 3-year terms. The commission has been in operation since 2007. Since that time, the commission has received 1,837 claims of innocence. To date, the commission has closed 1,724 of those claims. The commission has 131 active claims at this time. And those range all the way from claim processing, where we are waiting on a questionnaire from a claimant, all the way into the formal inquiry stage. The commission received 198 claims in 2015, and this is on par with the average that we receive each year, which is right around 200. Also, 9 individuals have been exonerated through the investigations of the commission. This is a very, very brief overview that I've given you. I'm going to talk about the budget next, but if anybody had questions about this, now it would be a great time.
Just because I like interesting things, the process says if the executive director determines there's new evidence or credible, verifiable evidence, the commission staff presents the case to the commission. Is there an appeals process for that?
There is not. Okay. Per the statute, all decisions of the commission are final.
But I mean the...
The commission, the director, yes.
Okay. So there's no way that the full commission could say, we want to look at this anyway?
No, the cases are brought to the commission at the director's recommendation.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I had a question, Mr. Chairman, on that same slide. Talking about the 3-judge panel and it had to be unanimous. I was just wondering if there's ever been 2-to-1 votes.
There has. I believe there's 1 case where there was a 2-to-1 vote and it was not... It was determined that the person had not proven their innocence by clear and convincing evidence. Okay. The next bit of information I have for you is a little bit about our budget. Although the commission is an independent agency, we are housed under the Administrative Office of the Courts for administrative purposes. So that includes HR, finance, budgeting, among other things. The commission follows AOC policies for administrative policies, HR policies, travel policies, and others. In 2015, fiscal year 2015, our certified appropriation from the General Assembly was $536,877. This covers all of our operating expenses as well as our 6 full-time staff. If you'll see up there in fiscal year 2014, we spent all but $25 of our budget from the AOC appropriated funds. So the money is being spent. 89.5% of our budget covers full-time staff, and about 10.5% of the budget is actually used for operating expenses. This includes, but is not limited to, things like building maintenance, janitorial services, lawn care, and utilities that are split among AOC agencies, as well as expert witnesses, transcription services, DNA testing, forensic testing, investigative travel, training, general office supplies and equipment, computers, internet, phone, data, all of those things, reference books, and postage and shipping. In 2015, the commission received a grant from the National Institute of Justice in the amount of $565,639. This is a 2-year grant, so that's about $282,819.50 per year. The award period is January 2016 through December of 2017. We have previously received this award in 2009 and 2012. So we've continuously received funding from NIJ since January of 2010, and will continue until December of 2017. This funding is limited in that it can only be used for costs associated with reviewing cases, searching for evidence, and DNA testing in violent felony cases where DNA testing may prove innocence. So it's kind of a limited niche area. It also covers salary and benefits for two full-time staff members, which brings our total staff to 8. The commission spends approximately $115,000 per year to cover DNA testing, forensic analysis, and experts. In fiscal year 2015, we have a line item of about $16,400 for DNA testing, forensic testing, and experts from the General Assembly, from our certified budget. So our 2015 NIJ grant will cover those costs through 2017. The 2009 and 2012 grants have done that since 2010. Since the commission originally received this grant in 2009, we've seen a significant change both in criteria for awarding the grant as well as a significant decrease in the amount of funding that the grant, that the NIJ is giving out. For example, in 2009, they awarded $9.85 million to 9 state agencies under the grant. In 2015, that number has been reduced to $3.55 million to 8 agencies. In 2015, the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission was the only state agency to receive funding under this grant. All other recipients this year were public universities and units of local government. And that is because until 2015, only state agencies could apply. However, in 2015, they changed the solicitation and allowed public universities, local governments, and state agencies to apply. This is indicating a shift in that program's focus. And the commission feels incredibly lucky to have received this funding in 2015, given that shift. We believe that's a testament to the success of the commission has had under the past two awards. We've repeatedly heard from NIJ that they are impressed with the work that we've been able to do and the way that we've spent their money. I'll also point out that 7 of the commission's 9 exonerations have been directly funded with money from the federal grant. We could not conduct the necessary testing that we need in cases without that funding or additional funds from the General Assembly. In closing, I'd like to thank the General Assembly for creating the commission in 2006 and being supportive of us since that time, both in funding and in statutory changes that we've brought to all of you. The commission was created to instill public confidence in the criminal justice system and to give post-conviction innocence claims an opportunity for a thorough, neutral investigation. In addition to the 9 exonerations that I've already spoken about, we've also confirmed guilt in approximately 20% of our claims, including at least 6 cases in which we've affirmatively and definitively concluded guilt through DNA testing. The commission staff has become very skilled at conducting these in-depth investigations in neutral, fact-finding manner. We've been in law enforcement agencies, clerk's offices, district attorney's offices, and evidence rooms across the state in a way that most individuals and agencies don't get to do. By working with law enforcement agencies, district attorneys, clerk's offices, and others, the commission has successfully located evidence in dozens of cases. Moreover, the commission has located evidence and files in 22 cases in which other people had already looked and had been told that it didn't exist or had said that they couldn't find it, that it would have been missing or destroyed. In some of those cases, the prior searches had been ordered by the court with findings of fact that the evidence was in fact missing because the court had been told that it was missing. 7 of the 9 exonerations involved files or evidence that had previously been declared destroyed or missing that were located by the commission. I'm very proud of the work that the commission staff has done over the last 9 years to get the commission where it is today. We are looking forward to many more successes, and we appreciate all of your support. I'm happy to meet with each of you individually, and if you want to hear from commissioners, law enforcement, prosecutors, attorneys, or even exonerees who have worked with the commission under the current model, we'd be happy to try to arrange that for you. We are, like I said, very proud of the work the commission has been able to get done in the last 9 years. So. Questions?
Questions. Ms. Stevens.
I actually have three.
Okay.
If you have, in fact, confirmed actual guilt for people.
Yes.
Are they still entitled to motions for appropriate relief?
Maybe on other issues. The statute requires us to turn over our findings of guilt to law enforcement and prosecutors, and we do that. They sign an affidavit of innocence prior to us conducting DNA testing, and so the district attorney is then at liberty to charge them with perjury if they choose. We have no control over that. It can also affect parole and things of that nature.
Technically, there's nothing in statute that prohibits them from filing an MAR when you confirm it.
That would be correct.
Okay. Where do you get your applications from? I mean, do the individuals file it, or,
yeah,
or is there a group out there that gets together and says this one needs to file?
No. Typically, most of our applicants come from through the mail from prison. Sometimes folks are out of prison when they apply, and they can be out of prison. That's one thing I didn't mention. They can already be out of prison when they apply. The bulk of our applicants just send in a letter or make a phone call and ask us to look into their case. We then send out a 22-page questionnaire, which they're required to fill out, and when they return it, we begin the process of determining whether or not their claim meets the criteria.
And is there any kind of statute of limitations, any kind of you need to file within a certain
No.
Representative Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, I had a few questions as well, and I'll follow up on Representative Stevens' question because that was one of mine. As far as, not that there's a statute of limitations, but I imagine when this started in 2007 that you were reviewing, or the commission was reviewing cases that might be 30 or 40 years old. Last year you had 198 filed. Can you give us a general feeling of how old those cases were that you were reviewing now?
They range. We still get cases from the 70s. We've gotten cases from, I know, the 60s. I'm not sure if before, but I definitely know we've gotten cases from the 60s. But we are still getting cases from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, even today. We do get some from recent years. I've seen, you know, a lot from the last 3 to 5 years as well.
Okay. And follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
And how does the 198 number compare to in 2014 or 2013, just rough numbers?
In 2014, we had 180 claims. The average is right around 200. We had one year where we had about 237. I think that's the biggest year. So it tends to be right around the 200 range.
Senator Wells.
Follow up on that, Mr. Chairman, thank you. It might be helpful to see an annual number instead of just the last year. And the
sure.
Total number, I think, for those of us that like to look at numbers and trends.
I can get that for you. I don't have it with me, but I do have it available. Yes. That's something we track.
Any further questions? I see your mother's here.
She is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Sharp is for the Capitol Defender. And he is going to make that presentation now.
Thank you, Representative Daughtry. At this time, I'm going to try and get familiar with this thing real quick. All right, figured that out. Name's Rob Sharp. I'm the interim capital defender for the state. A little bit about me, since if 7 years is a rocky marriage, 5 months is a honeymoon. Maybe not, but I was appointed August 1st of 2015. I have experience having served in the Army Reserve National Guard for 8 years. I've been licensed practice law since 97, and for some reason I couldn't add that number up right, and I got 19 years instead of 18 years on that. The presentation's designed to cover cases covered by IDS and the Office of Capital Defender Policies, Office of Capital Defender Duties, Staff, and Composition, capital defense spending in North Carolina, funding for experts in capital cases, and the future of capital defense in North Carolina. One of the things that's going to be useful is for us to look at the definition of potentially capital cases. And we've got a rule. IDS has a rule, 2A.1 subsection A. What I've done is under that rule, I've simply laid out what that rule means. It means that a potentially capital case is a first-degree murder case or an undesignated form of murder where the potential punishment that is potentially punishable by death and where the defendant is 18 years of age or older at the time of offense. In North Carolina, we have more than 1,000 pending potentially capital cases at any given time. One of the things, this slide is entitled Why We Must Assign Qualified Capital Trial Counsel, and some of the reasons are because we have a broad death penalty scheme. Another is, even though we do have a Rule 24 in the General Rules of Practice that allow us to state a date and a time where we're supposed to, where the state's supposed to indicate their intention to seek the death penalty or not, the DA still retain the authority to declare a case capital even after that. And of course, we have the ABA guidelines for the appointment and performance of defense counsel in death penalty cases. But I would submit that there are two additional reasons that we want to assign qualified counsel. The first is somewhat obvious. These are serious cases. We need to make sure that we have qualified counsel to ensure that the presumption of innocence is carried forward and that the defendant's rights are protected and all those things you ordinarily think about. But there's a second reason, and that's the victim's families. One of the surest ways to guarantee that a verdict will not stand is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. I believe you touched on this a little bit earlier. Now, I'm a qualified capital trial attorney, and that's a specialized area of law. However, I can't do real estate title searches. I can't do it. I've tried. Equitable distribution cases, I have tried that as well. But this is a specialized area of law, just like those are. Now, this shows us basically how cases have proceeded from fiscal year 02 to fiscal year 2016. We start off with this pot of cases. It's approximately 6,500, and you'll notice that fully three-quarters of those cases will eventually end up in a conviction of second degree or less. Now, conviction's a misnomer because some of those will be dismissed or people will be found not guilty or those types of things. So you take that pot, that initial pot where we have to protect those folks and we have to, for those various reasons, make sure we have qualified counsel, and you break it down to a group of approximately 1,600 cases where the state has at least indicated initially that we're proceeding capitally. In other words, we are seeking the death penalty on that case. And then you look at the remaining proceeding non-capitally. From that proceeding capitally, it breaks down again to cases that then become non-capital. In other words, at some point a court or the district attorney exercises their discretion and decides to not seek the death penalty. So now we've got this pool of 1,385 cases. Out of that pool, a little over half, about 56%, will still result in a second degree conviction or plea, or the second degree or less, or those individuals will be found not guilty or the like. You end up with eventually a group of 1,100 cases that proceed capitally but are disposed through other means, in other words, dismissals or plea bargains, and then you have 274 capital trials. There are three types, basically, of capital counsel appointments. In other words, there are three instances, basically, that my office will be called upon to make a capital appointment. The initial appointment is where somebody's charged with first-degree murder or undesignated degree of murder, and they were over the age of 18 on the date of offense. That's just kind of the basics of it. The next is the substitute appointment of counsel. An attorney's withdrawn or been removed by the court, and we need to appoint another attorney. Oftentimes, this is the result of finding a conflict. An attorney will be reviewing their records and will discover a conflict. Perhaps they've represented a witness against the client, but didn't find that out until they'd received or reviewed all of the discovery. One of the things we're emphasizing in our training is we're trying to emphasize the fact that the attorneys need to be more mindful, and I believe they are becoming more mindful of recognizing these conflicts early on. And the last is that the district attorney or the state indicates that the state will be seeking the death penalty. In that instance, the client is entitled to two lawyers, two qualified capital attorneys instead of just one. The need for capital counsel is relatively steady between, in the calendar years, I've put this bar thing, graph out here, from 2012 to 2015, it's hovered between 574 and 650 actual appointments that needed to be made. As you can see, that does remain steady. And you need to remember that there may only be one victim, but more than one person may be charged with first-degree murder. This is particularly true in instances of felony first-degree murder, which is also known as felony murder. And that occurs when certain delineated felonies, such as armed robbery, if a death is a result of the armed robbery, then an individual may be charged with felony murder. The upshot of it is that you end up with a armed robbery where you have one person who was a shooter or killer who took a life, but you may end up with a handful, say five defendants charged with first-degree murder. This is a map of the counties that required the appointment of a capital qualified attorney in calendar year 2015. The red indicates areas of appointment required, and I'd want it to go back and sort of chart this out, but just have not at this time. But I'd like to chart it out and see how years into the past what this looks like.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
The capital defenders have been sent to these different counties throughout the state. Where are they? Where are the capital defenders located in general?
Yes, sir. I'm putting the cart in front of the horse, and I apologize for that. We've got four offices. We've got one office, satellite office in Buncombe. We've got one in New Hanover. We've got one in Forsyth, and our main office is located out of Durham.
And how many lawyers do you have in, say, Buncombe?
In Buncombe County, I have two attorneys.
And if you don't mind, go through the rest of those.
Yes, sir. Actually, I do have that coming up in if that's all right. Bless you. Okay, the duties of the Office of Capital Defender are my duties specifically are to supervise and manage full-time litigators and support staff in our four regional offices, which is Buncombe, Durham, Forsyth, and New Hanover. It's also to maintain a capital roster of qualified attorneys, and these attorneys are private assigned counsel, as you would imagine, but they're also the assistant public defenders, chief public defenders who do this work, and the assistant capital defenders. We also approve or deny expert funding requests in all potentially capital cases at the trial level, except as it relates to cases which have been declared exceptional, and I'll discuss that in a moment, And some of the more important duties that we have, well, I don't want to say important, but for me, some of the more exciting duties are the to recruit, support, and train qualified capital trial counsel. And this is just a copy so that you'll have it of the IDS rule as it relates to what it takes to be those particular attorneys. As it relates to savings, part of what we're trying to do is we're giving a preference for salaried attorneys, the appointment of salaried attorneys when that is possible. In 2013, IDS expanded the Office of the Capital Defender, and so we try to appoint those assistant capital defenders and local public defenders or assistant public defenders whenever that's possible. The goal has been to provide qualified counsel in the most effective, cost-effective manner. There's also been some legislation that allows public defenders to go to adjacent counties or districts and to perform representation in that way, and that's been helpful. The increase in our budget over the past few years is part of an emphasis, and we believe has led to a decrease in private assigned counsel expenditures in these types of cases. Another thing from a cost savings is we have a preference for in-county attorneys. And I won't belabor that point except to say that there are some counties where we have no qualified attorneys on the roster. And sometimes we have these multiple co-defendants, which makes the appointment of out-of-county counsel necessary. Now, here is where I've got the basic structure down, Representative Daughtry. We have the main offices in Durham, and our satellites are Buncombe, Forsyth, and New Hanover. The personnel are, as stated out here, the Capital Defender. I myself make the actual appointments. The Deputy Capital Defender, her duties, she has a number of duties, one of which is to look at the funding, the expert funding. We have 14 assistant capital defenders and a vacant assistant capital defender position. We've got a capital defender, an assistant capital defender, who I wrote down consultation coordination duties, but she actually does training as well. And we have a legal assistant who helps with the consultation coordination, and another legal assistant who is our case coordinator. We have 6 investigators and 3 legal assistants. Right here lays out the offices and the locations of these particular individuals.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Wouldn't it be a better idea to spread those lawyers around that are now presently congregated in Durham to other parts of the state? I know Durham's a pretty wild place, but you don't
need to. It is wild enough. The answer to that question is that part of what we're doing is we're examining the need for the Office of Capital Defender presence in certain areas that are lacking in private assigned counsel. And before I would answer that in the affirmative, I have not looked at yet or completed looking at the efficiency or cost effectiveness of that, but I certainly think that is an idea that we should be examining.
Some judges complain that the lawyers in Durham will be assigned to a county that's somewhere in the state, and they drive there and for an administrative term, and won't the case continue, or they won't get there, and it seemed to me to be better to have them close by rather than so far away.
I will say one of the emphasis in this file, and the problem is you're not going to recognize any you're not going to recognize an immediate savings, but during the 5 months I've been there, you know, our general policy is that we appoint from within. It's been the policy of IDS for some time to appoint within county and to then go to the adjacent counties. But I've been following that policy more strictly, is how I'd prefer to say that. I do believe, I'm going to skip through some of this. Okay. When it comes to the expensive cases that we hear about, a lot of these are the exception. To be sure, these cases do cost money, but half of these cases cost less than $18,500, and 72% have expert costs that total less than $10,000. We'll notice that certain cost control policies have been put in place. Of course, we've talked about the reduction, 2011 reduction in private assigned counsel rates. There's also a policy in the Office of the Capital Defender, it's an IDS policy, wherein if a case has been declared non-capital, then the private assigned counsel rate is moved from $85 per hour to $75 per hour. If a determination has not been made pursuant to that Rule 24 we were discussing earlier, within 12 months after the 12 months after the warrant date, and a capital declaration has not been made, then at that point, that attorney, instead of recouping $85 per hour, that's $75 as well. We also have an exceptional case policy, wherein we set pretrial limits for attorneys of $35,000 for the attorney and $10,000 for investigators or mitigation specialists. And if they are going to approach those numbers, then they have to meet with the IDS executive director. The benefit of that is that obviously it makes the attorneys more mindful of their spending as it's going along. But the additional benefits are that once a case is declared exceptional, the attorneys are required to bill on a quarterly basis. And we've also got a pretrial budget that has been set up since fiscal year of 2013, and that applies to the more or most serious cases. Here is a funding for the potentially capital cases at the trial level. This is just a chart that shows that overall. You'll notice that 22.7% of the funding is used for the Office of the Capital Defender and the experts, the outside experts that we use, that does include the other experts I discussed that we have in-house. 52.9% applies to private assigned counsel, and the remainder is the private assigned counsel experts. We should note that, and this is not written correctly, we put $5.74 million. This number should be $5.3 million. But we would note that to reduce the potentially capital spending by approximately $5.3 million, if we did that, that would only cover a $5 increase in non-capital private assigned counsel hourly rate. The Office of the Capital Defender budget itself is 6/10 of it are attorney personnel costs, 17% are the non-attorney personnel, where 60% is the attorney, and then I've just got that laid out for you. This is a little bit about us. The average assistant capital defender, unlike a lot of offices can go and recruit fresh out of law school, they can recruit folks fresh out of law school and train them and do that type of thing. As we said, it has to be qualified attorneys, and so I have to have attorneys that already have trial experience. And, of course, it's very varied background. You're looking at attorneys who have served as district attorneys, or assistant district attorneys, rather. It's just a really good mix of folks. Now, the Office of the Capital Defender has, over the years, gradually expanded, and there was a more recognizable expansion, we would say, within between fiscal year 14 and 15. But when we look at the potentially capital cases at the trial level, when we look at these specific cases and the attorney costs only, what you will notice is you will notice that the overall, once you combine the Office of Capital Defender and the private assigned counsel, once you combine both of those, you'll notice that the costs go down. So even though the Office of Capital Defender costs, the office, inner office costs has an increase, it reflects our viewpoint that we ultimately end up being efficient and saving money by doing that. There also is a value-added component to the Office of Capital Defender. We perform case consults for the private assigned counsel. These consults are actually required by IDS rule under circumstances where private assigned counsel, where a case has been declared death penalty, in other words, capital. And we have trial calendar meetings where we are able to track and see what the experts, where they are at, and if they have been retained in a certain case and that type of thing. Part of this is to minimize that ineffective assistance of counsel claims that we discussed earlier. The individual case assistant capital defender caseloads hover between 6 to 8. There are a number of reasons for that, some of which is that we can't go higher than, we seldom go higher than 8 because we don't feel like the individual's going to be able to render constitutional or the effective assistance of counsel. We become concerned once somebody goes over 8. And having handled these cases, I will tell you, that's a good caseload. But you don't have to quite take my word for it. When we look at other jurisdictions and just do a comparison, you take that 6 to 8 number that I just told you about and you compare it to Texas, they have a maximum of 6. They don't let you handle more than 6. And my non-administrative assistant capital defenders, they better have 6. So they're between 6 and 8. And then you've got other places that we've included on there for you to look at that have even lower capital caseloads. The right to expert funding is both statutory and constitutional, and it's laid out, at least the case everyone always talks about, is Akey versus Oklahoma. There are a couple of different types of experts. They're the types of experts that we all think about when we think about experts. Psychologists, psychiatrists, DNA, forensics, all of those things. And to be sure, they play a role. But there's another type of expert, such as investigators, mitigation specialists, and even paralegals. And they have lower hourly rates than attorneys. So we have been finding that it is cost effective to use them. And so in a lot of instances where an attorney may, we may speak or consult with an attorney, we'll steer them in this direction, not towards things that they need to be doing, but to make sure that you have, let's say, a paralegal who we're paying $15 an hour doing something instead of paying an attorney $75 an hour. We use the same expert hourly rates as the prosecutors do. The IDS rule indicates that counsel will be required to make at least the same type of showing as Akey versus Oklahoma, which is it needs to be an exacting, we use the standard of an exacting trial judge. And to show, or to at least demonstrate, that by and large, you know, we don't, well, not by and large, we don't. I'm telling you, we don't take that duty lightly. In 38.4% of the instances, we do not grant any funding, or we grant less funding than the attorney is seeking. Final thing I've got for you is the future of capital defense in North Carolina. One of the things I had wanted to talk about at this time, and we've already touched on it, so I won't do much more with it, is that I believe we need to examine the need for the Office of Capital Defender presence in areas lacking private roster attorneys. And again, I'll need to examine the efficiency and cost effectiveness of that. I believe Mr. Maher's presentation showed that in 2015, September, there was a School of Government survey of the district and Superior Court judges, at least as it relates to them and the overall satisfaction with the IDS administration and potentially capital cases. There is a level of satisfaction. This is more important than anything else, and this is where we need to continue improving. Judicial concerns, there are judicial concerns about too many out-of-county attorneys, and there are legislative concerns about too many out-of-county attorneys. What I have proposed, what I've been working with, is trying to maximize the use of the in-county counsel whenever possible, and I've been trying to recruit the next generation of capital trial attorneys. And, you know, just perfect control of an audience. Of course, I wait until the very end to put this in my presentation. I apologize. I should have started with this. Here are the areas where we need more private capital trial attorneys. The blue indicates that those are counties wherein we have no qualified roster attorneys, and the yellow is where we only have one qualified roster attorney. The red stars are the four offices or satellite offices. And of course, I've been traveling across states speaking with judges and attorneys in an effort to do this recruitment. People ask about the best way to have a real impact on costs. I think I just said a good way to have an impact on costs. Okay? Keeping counsel in county is a good way to impact costs. The larger cost realization will have to come from either a narrowing of the broad capital punishment statute, or in our non-capital declarations, those should be binding. That would be another place. There could be an examination of the statutorily aggravating factors. We have some that other counties don't have, such as EHAC, which is especially heinous, atrocious, and cruel. Or there could be an examination on the limitation of felony murder in such a way that either felony or murder is eliminated as being something for which someone is death penalty eligible, or in the alternative, that the death penalty eligibility would only apply to either a shooter or killer in those types of instances. I'll be glad to. First of all, I appreciate the time, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
I got one.
Yes, sir.
You talked about when you fund experts.
Yes, sir.
And the case, I believe you said, the standard was an exacting judge.
Yes, sir.
Wouldn't it be sensible to let the presiding judge, if you were to fund an expert, let him say whether or not the funding was reasonable or unreasonable? Presiding judge?
Counsel can take any of our decisions. They can actually take those to their superior court judge, and they very often will. For the purposes of a statewide standard, or in other words, a standard that is applied evenly throughout the entire state. That's why I think that was the thinking behind the way we do it now.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Our last speaker is Ms. Mumma, Ms. Christine Mumma. She is the executive director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, which is a different animal than North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. She has been involved in this innocence project since 2005 when I first met her. She and Justice Lake came to the General Assembly with this idea of an actual innocence commission. It was not received enthusiastically, but over a period of time, we actually established it, and it has done yeoman's work. Ms. Mumma.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here today. I'm actually in a kind of a unique position in that I am a commissioner for IDS, so I'm familiar with that process, and I drafted the legislation that established the Innocence Inquiry Commission, so I'm familiar with that process. I've had several cases that have gone through the commission, so that I have the experience as the defense counsel in those cases, and I've been doing innocence work for 15 years, so I have that perspective. I also have the unique opportunity of being last, so I get to comment on a couple of things that I've heard so far. One is with regard to the commissioners for the Indigent Defense Services and what our responsibilities are. Although you've heard that we meet on a quarterly basis, what I don't think you've heard is the other work we do beyond those quarterly meetings. The committees that I serve on include the Systems Evaluation Committee, the Executive Committee, the Legislative Committee, the Budget Committee, and the Long-Term Planning Committee. I can assure you that there is never a week that I am not in communication with the staff at the office about some issue that is happening. So our roles as commissioners go way beyond the quarterly meeting. We truly are involved in the detail of the operations of that organization. And I have 9 years business experience before going to law school and know about managing the bottom line and looking at the operation, and I can tell you that the people over there do a fantastic job of it. So if you have questions, please ask them, because they have the answers for you. With regard to the question about the input from judges and on having attorneys traveling from Durham to work on cases, and there's so many factors that go into that answer, and sometimes we hear things about exceptional cases, and exceptional cases are exactly that. That is not the way the process works typically. You have to look at where the trials take place. You have to look at what the private appointed counsel availability is. You have to look at what the caseloads are for the people who are currently there. You have to look at the overhead expenses and how to manage those overhead expenses. And you have to look at the resources and the best way to have the resources in place. So I'll take off my IDS hat and go back to the innocence hat. And I will, Representative Jackson, in response to your question about the three-judge panel, there actually has never been a three-judge panel that has been split. It has always been unanimous. So the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence. I've worked with the center since 2001. It was established as a nonprofit in 2000, and so it's been at very early stages when I came on board. First thing I want to do is talk about the difference between the innocence organizations, because it's pretty much innocence everywhere, and I'm sure you get that feeling. So there's different organizations with different purposes. There's a National Innocence Network, and you heard before about how that was established, started in New York at the Cardozo Law School. That network is made up of 64 innocence organizations. The North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence is one of those organizations. We are a nonprofit. We are funded through grant funding and personal donations. We coordinate, the center coordinates the work of students, law students on innocence cases at Elon, UNC, NCCU, and Campbell. But we also conduct all case screening for those four schools plus Duke. So we try and consolidate everything into one place so there's not duplication of efforts. And we provide a training opportunity for law students so that they can get their noses out of the books and into real cases. And it's great learning experience for them. They're always working under the supervision of someone at the center. We also work on policy work. And we educate. I travel the state and the country educating on criminal justice reform for issues that are associated with wrongful convictions, reforms that can be put in place to increase the reliability of conviction without impacting the conviction of the guilty. And that is always something that we keep in mind, because what the work that we're doing is a double-edged sword. If there is someone who's innocent in prison, there is a guilty person on the street committing more crimes. So we want to increase the reliability and make sure the right person is in prison serving time for the crime that's been committed. The other organizations within our agencies within North Carolina that are network members include the Duke Law Wrongful Conviction Clinic and the Wake Forest Law Innocence and Justice Clinic. We all coordinate our work to cover the entire state and, again, make sure we're as efficient as possible. In 2002, Representative Daughtry mentioned the Chief Justice's Commission. It was established by Chief Justice I. Beverly Lake as a study commission. It was made up of 32 members. It included prosecutors, law enforcement, judges, victim advocates, academics, defense attorneys, actually a number of defense attorneys, because we wanted to meet with the people who could really have an impact. And unfortunately, a lot of times that's not defense attorneys. I was executive director of that commission. The work was policy work only, no cases. So we were very careful not to bring any cases into the mix. It wasn't about pointing fingers. It was about improving the overall justice system. Justice Lake had mandatory retirement in 2006, a law I wish you would work on. And in 2007, Chief Justice Parker took over the commission, and it really became inactive under her term in, as Chief Justice. Part of the work we did through that study commission was look at post-conviction claims of innocence. And I'm going to go through some of the other work we did, but that is what led to the establishment of the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. It was established by the work of that 32-member commission, which started working on it in 2004, voted to adopt recommendations in 2005, presented the legislature with the recommendation and drafted the legislation, and then worked with important leaders like Representative Daughtry in making sure that legislation passed. It is, you've heard a lot from the director about how that works, and that is only casework. So again, you have the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, nonprofit, which does casework and policy work. The Chief Justice's Commission, which only does policy work and is not active right now, and the Innocence Inquiry Commission, which focuses on the casework, which is a state-funded or federally funded organization. So, why is innocence important? You've heard there's been 337 DNA exonerations in the country so far. The average sentence is 14 years. The longest is 37. Identifying the true perpetrator is absolutely important in all of these cases, and in 43% of the cases, the true perpetrator has been identified through the same DNA evidence that was used to exonerate someone who was proven innocent. In those cases, 130 violent crimes were committed by the true perpetrator while the innocent person was incarcerated. In North Carolina, there's been 41 exonerations. That's as it's tracked by the National Registry of Exonerations. I've gone through those, and I know that there are some people who question whether something is really an exoneration, and I would say that 30 of them, people would not argue with the fact that they are truly exonerations. 20 of those people were exonerated with forensic evidence, 18 with DNA, 2 with fingerprint. And in those cases, 17 true perpetrators in North Carolina have been identified. So that's the North Carolina statistics. And when we talk about victims receiving justice, if the wrong person is in prison, the only way the victim can receive true justice is by identifying the true perpetrator. So why? What causes wrongful convictions, and what have we done about it? The first topic the Chief Justice Study Commission took up was the eyewitness identification, and I don't know if I mentioned that I was the executive director of the Chief Justice Study Commission, so I am familiar with the work that was done through that commission. The eyewitness identification misidentification occurs in 72% of the cases. We took up that issue first, and in 2007, North Carolina passed the Eyewitness Identification Reform Act. That legislation was updated this past session to include show-ups. And we were the first state in the country to have legislation on ID reform. The second issue we took up with the study commission was false confessions and the benefits of recording interrogations. False confessions or admissions of guilt occur in 27% of cases nationally. North Carolina is actually a little higher than that percentage. But the advantages of recording of interrogations are much greater for law enforcement and prosecution than they are for defense. Actually, defense attorneys don't like when there's a recorded interrogation and they can't argue that there was duress and they can't argue the facts were fed to the defendant. They lose all those arguments to take to court. So this is an efficiency for the court system overall. And that law was passed in 2007, again, from the work of the Actual Innocence Commission. Informant testimony is 15% nationally. In North Carolina, in the exoneration cases we have, it's more like 37%. It occurs in 37% of the exoneration cases. The Actual Innocence Commission was not able to reach that issue before it became inactive. House Bill 700 went through committee this past session, and as bills sometimes do, mysteriously disappeared after that point. Ineffective assistance of counsel and official misconduct. I don't have a percentage on that because, that is, again, I think we all acknowledge that ineffective assistance to counsel is something that needs to be worked on, and that is exactly what we did with the Indigent Defense Services Act of 2000, was raise the bar for the standard of people who are representing those who are accused, not only to prevent conviction of the innocent, but to decrease the appeals, decrease the challenges of ineffective assistance to counsel, decrease the post-conviction motions for appropriate relief. Invalidated sciences, some people refer to it as junk science. I don't like to use the word junk science because we didn't know some of these things, bite mark, tool mark, blood spatter, hair analysis. We didn't know they weren't valid until we had DNA. So we've now learned what the sciences are that are not really science and what we have to validate through further work. So in 47% of the cases nationally, and it's about the same for North Carolina, there has been evidence that was considered scientific evidence used to convict someone that has been proven to be invalid. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Looking at these numbers, I know you said the 15 is more like 37 in North Carolina. What was the percentage on the ineffective assistance of counsel, did you say?
So I don't have a percentage for ineffective assistance of counsel or official misconduct. And I do that actually out of respect for the officials because, unfortunately, there would be a high percentage of what you would call misconduct, which I mean that is undisclosed evidence, exculpatory evidence, bribery of witnesses. Law enforcement practices have changed a lot over the years. We are much better at doing what we do now. But for a very long time, they lacked in controls. And so it was more people thinking they were framing a guilty person, which if you're convinced someone's committed a crime and you want to make sure they go to prison, then you might take steps you shouldn't take. So
can you give an example of that? For example, the guy who served 17 years?
The last exoneree was Joseph Sledge, who served 37 years, is now 71, and served 37 years for a double murder he did not commit. In that case, two jailhouse informants were paid cash, one $2,000, one $3,000, which in 1976 was not small dollars. That's about $20,000 if you do present value calculations. For drug-addicted individuals, that's really good money. Both of them had charges dropped. One would have served an additional 10 years for charges he was facing. The other got out of prison early for a murder that he had committed. So they were both given deals for their testimony. So that's the most recent case that we had.
Follow up. All right, so with these numbers, though, they added to 161. So what's going on? Just multiple characteristics,
so,
or what?
Eyewitness identification occurs in 72% of cases, but you may have other factors that appear in those cases as well. So once you have an ID where someone says, that's the person that committed the crime, that can lead to a false confession. That can lead to informant testimony. That can lead to faulty forensic evidence. So you may have factors that appear in several cases. Any other questions? So as far as the forensic sciences, the National Academy of Sciences report came out in 2009. In North Carolina, the Forensic Science Reform Act passed in 2011. That was a result of the Greg Taylor exoneration. That study group was established as a result of the Greg Taylor exoneration, and we've had major and very good reform in North Carolina since that time. Other reforms resulting from the Chief Justice's study commission, improvement of the statutory requirements for the preservation of biological evidence. Much work remains to be done, and I have made Representative Daughtry aware of the work that needs to be done. The establishment of the North Carolina Association for Property and Evidence, increased statutory compensation and services for the exonerated, increased education and awareness, which leads to improved processes in law enforcement and prosecution and defense, establishment of the country's first state agency, the Innocence Inquiry Commission, which you've heard about before. So why did we establish the Innocence Inquiry Commission? Yes, sir.
Yes. What is the NC Association for Property and Evidence, or was it proposed to be?
It is a... when you can bring people together who are working in the same field, and they can benefit from training and from the experiences in other evidence rooms, that's always beneficial. So the association was established it's a minimal fee to join for anybody who works as a custodian of evidence, not just biological evidence, but all evidence. So guns, money, drugs, biological evidence, whatever it is. Okay, so why an Innocence Inquiry Commission? The exonerations we were seeing back in the early 2000s were not resulting from the effective workings of the justice system. They typically resulted from very good journalism, journalists publishing articles, doing investigative journalism, and that led to exonerations, and that's not the way our justice system should work. We also hear a lot about the volume of post-conviction motions, and the lack of credibility of those claims, and that leads to cynicism, and that leads to overloading more our already overloaded and underfunded justice system. So when you have an innocence claim that gets buried in the masses, we needed to find a way to pull those out and make sure they got the appropriate attention. Finality of convictions, procedural default, that's both about the same thing. The post-conviction laws are written to limit access post-conviction, because we are focused on finality. We are trying to move on to the next case. But if it is a valid innocence claim, again, we need to be able to spot it and address it. We have an adversarial system, and a lot of times the adversarial system is not suited to resolving credible claims of innocence. And then access, and you've heard from the director of the Innocence Inquiry Commission how in 22 cases where defense attorneys or others were told evidence no longer exists, files are not there, we can't find anything, and the commission goes in and is able to find something relatively quickly, or sometimes evidence is found just because they announce the fact that they're coming. So access is very important. These are all problems that we might be able to address and we should address through our normal justice system, but if we're not going to, they have to be addressed another way, which is why the Innocence Inquiry Commission was established. And it's, although these are words, it's important to put the faces with the words. These are real people. Dwayne Dale went to prison when he was 19 years old. He spent 18 years incarcerated for a rape he did not commit. While he was incarcerated, he was raped and beaten and sold and bartered for, and he will never be the same again. And it took 9 years to find the evidence that he asked to be tested. Regina Lane was brutally beaten and raped after Daryl Hunt was incarcerated for a rape he didn't commit, while the true perpetrator was on the street committing more crimes. So these are people with stories and lives that are lost, which is why we have to find a way to pull these claims out and make sure they're properly addressed. So the impact of delayed release, relief is, I've talked about, the prolonged incarceration of the innocent, the continued victimization by the perpetrator, the lack of closure and justice for the victim, decreased public confidence, the costs associated with the criminal justice system with the repeated Joseph Sledge filed 23 motions for appropriate relief on his own behalf. People had to read those. People had to look at those and answer those. And then the cost of compensation in civil suits. In North Carolina, there's been $7.6 million paid in statutory compensation for those who've been wrongfully convicted, $25 million in civil suit damages. So there are real dollars assigned to these problems. So we have the establishment of the Innocence Inquiry Commission. How did that happen? Again, the study commission began looking at it in January 2004. UK has a criminal case review commission that we looked at as a model. The difference is in the UK, the criminal case review commission actually looks at all appeals, all appeal issues. The innocence cases are only about 5% of their load. But we did actually had somebody come over from the UK to meet with us and talk about it, to us about that process. And we used their process, kept that in mind as we were developing the Innocence Inquiry Commission, because that process is an inquisitorial process. We are temporarily taking a case out of the adversarial system, putting it into an inquisitorial system while it's investigated, and then putting it back into the adversarial system. The work passed the recommendations for the Innocence Inquiry Commission passed by vote again in May 2005, passed the House and Senate in 2006, became law in 2006, and really started at work in 2007. It was the first commission of its kind in the United States. We are now seeing, there are other states looking at this process, Texas, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, California, Virginia, but there are also, it also led to the other states starting conviction integrity units, which are being modeled after what we did in North Carolina. Conviction integrity units, the difference is they are within prosecutor offices. So prosecutors actually have staff that are 100% dedicated to looking at any post-conviction claims of innocence. And those staff members have access to the evidence, access to the documents, and work cooperatively with innocence projects to ensure that justice has been served. The problem with that is money. It takes money. And the departments where we're seeing this are the large offices, San Diego, Brooklyn, Manhattan, but all of them are getting up into the 20s. Texas, Dallas County alone has had 26 exonerations through its conviction integrity unit. So again, from a business perspective, it's always about continuous improvement. So identifying the problem, exploring the options, setting goals for what you want to fix, and then implementing and reevaluating. And we knew this was the process we were going to have to go through when we established the Innocence Inquiry Commission in 2006. It was a new process. It needed to be looked at after it was implemented. It needed to be reevaluated and then and potentially changed. So I am going to spend some time going through some of the things we've seen, looking at the process and recommendations we have. I was part of the original team that drafted the legislation, so I do know not only what the intent of the drafters were, but the intent of the people who passed the law. The IIC has a backlog of cases. Some cases have been investigation or formal inquiry for over 4 years. So during that time, justice can't be brought for anybody. And defendants don't know whether they should proceed through a motion for appropriate relief, whether they should stay with the Innocence Inquiry Commission, what their option is. The victims don't know what's happening with a claim that's pending. So the recommendation that I would propose would be limiting applications to homicide, robbery, and sex offenses, and allowing referral from an attorney for all other felonies. This is the applicant detail for 2014 and 2015 from the Innocence Inquiry Commission. So you can see that in half of the pie is covered by murder, robbery, and sex offenses. All of the exonerations that have occurred so far through this process have been from those categories. So if we limited the applications to those areas, it would reduce their applications by half. We wouldn't have to eliminate access to it for everybody. If for the other crimes, if an attorney felt there was a credible claim of innocence, they could refer the case directly. It just wouldn't come directly from an inmate application. Yes?
Yes.
So is it your recommendation that we limit the types of cases that are eligible, or are you saying in response to inquiries you've received, if you had to do something, that's what you would recommend?
I personally have had three cases in formal inquiry for almost 5 years. So it is my personal recommendation, in conjunction with feedback from other people who have used the process, that we need to do something to move the cases more quickly. And so if the applications, opening a letter takes time. In my office, when I started, we got 1,200 letters a year, 1,200 applications a year. We run about a 98% rejection rate. So you're spending a lot of time opening letters. I'll be the first to admit, guilty people claim they're innocent. I absolutely will admit that. And Representative Stevens, to your question with regard to DNA, even in the work I do, if there's something that's tested that proves guilt, that would be available to the prosecutor. I can't touch the evidence. I can't send something off for testing without the prosecutor's involvement. So if there is an identification of a true perpetrator or evidence of guilt through testing, they're going to find out about it through any process. We don't want to exclude access, but limit the applications that come in. If you are committed, you are convicted for one of these other crimes, you could contact our office, you could contact Prisoner Legal Services, you could contact another attorney who could recommend review of your case, and that referral could come directly from the attorney. Although it's a different quality of resource that's opening the mail and responding, it's still a resource, it's still time.
Follow up?
Thank you. Do you have any opinion as to whether it would be better, are you picking these categories that you're talking about limiting it to based on the length of their sentence? I mean, should we have a rule that says unless you got at least 4 years in prison, there's no need for you to be eligible because it's going to take us 4 years to investigate it?
I'd like to cut the applications in half. So that's a nice clean cut right down there. Those are the most serious crimes with the longest sentences, and those are the crimes that you're most likely to have the benefit from forensics testing. So it all ties together very nicely. Transparency and accountability. Again, some of the cases have been with the Innocence Inquiry Commission for years. The district attorney and the defense counsel do not have any idea what the progress is in the case, so they can't make any informed decision about how to proceed. It's our recommendation that the district attorney, the defense counsel, and the referring counsel be given updates, confidential updates, every 6 months. And although you've heard a lot about exceptions to public records law, exception to public meetings law, and why that was because we wanted to protect law enforcement in particular from claims of misconduct that had no credibility. So the thinking was if we could keep it at a closed process until there was a credible claim that was being investigated, then there was no intention that it would be closed after that point. We wanted to protect our law enforcement and our prosecutors from false accusations. So at a minimum, the district attorney and the defense counsel, who the defense counsel actually has a very limited role in this process. If there's a referring counsel, they have a history with the case, so they should be provided with updates as well. Because again, if we can use our traditional post-conviction process, we should. The reason the inquiry commission was established was because that process was not working. Efficiency through consent. Although you heard of the 9 exoneration cases through the Innocence Inquiry Commission, 3 of those exonerations actually occurred through the MAR process, through consent of the parties. So with 6 people who went through hearing, 3 was through consent. And if the district attorney can see the evidence of innocence and the defense attorney sees the evidence of innocence and they both say there's sufficient evidence of innocence to merit judicial review, we don't need to spend the resources at the Innocence Inquiry Commission to continue to look at that case. Move it back into the adversarial system and resolve it the way it should be resolved. So if both parties, after their 6-month update, are satisfied that the burden at the 8-member panel, which is sufficient evidence of innocence to merit judicial review, the case moves out and goes directly to an adversarial process. And again, that would save resources and move the cases more quickly. There are concerns with appointment of counsel. Currently, counsel is not being appointed to defendants until after testing has been started. Not only is testing and consuming evidence in violation of statute, it is a violation of 15A-268 for the commission to be conducting testing or consuming evidence without notice to the defendant. But the defendants are exposed. And part of this process is in order for a defendant to participate in this process, they have to waive all of their rights. And they have to have an understanding they're waiving all of their rights. There is no attorney-client privilege. There is no marital privilege. All of those get waived if you want to take part in this unique process. There's unique responsibilities to being part of it. And you need the advice of counsel before that case moves forward. If testing is started and then the defendant decides he doesn't want to waive his rights, then we've wasted money and time looking at a case that shouldn't have been looked at in the first place. So our recommendation is that appointed counsel be appointed at the investigation stage, and the defendant shouldn't be interviewed or requested to give DNA sample without the waiver of rights. There's been stated that there's concern that the victims would have to be notified earlier if counsel is appointed, but we could always go back to the victim notifications that are required from Article 45 and 46 of the Criminal Procedures Act. Right now, the victim notifications within the Innocence Inquiry Commission are very early and very extensive, and we could revert back to victim notifications that occur in every other case post-conviction. Testing of alternate suspects. The burden of proof of the Innocence Inquiry Commission at the 8-member panel is sufficient evidence of innocence to merit judicial review. The exclusion of alternate suspects through DNA testing should not be part of that process. Although there may be cases where an alternate suspect could possibly be connected to a defendant and you might want to go ahead and test that alternate suspect, those should be the exceptions that require the commission chair to find good cause shown. I'm aware of cases where thousands, tens of thousands of dollars of testing have occurred on alternate suspects. And solving the crime is the state's responsibility after the innocent person is exonerated. The use of protective orders. Protective orders are currently being used by the Innocence Inquiry Commission over all files. Exonerees who've been exonerated after spending 20, 30 years in prison can't use their own files for their own purposes. Transparency was one of the objectives of establishing the Innocence Inquiry Commission. You cannot have transparency with the overuse of protective orders. So our recommendation is that the protective orders be limited and that the defendant and the district attorney have an opportunity to be heard if a protective order is going to be put in place. Again, defense attorneys and district attorneys can keep records confidential if they're working on a case until the case goes forward to a public hearing. Transparency and efficiency. Again, the district attorney and the defendants are not given the benefit of years of investigation and thousands of dollars in testing if a case does not go forward to hearing, or if a case goes to hearing and does not pass the 8-member panel. We recommend a confidential copy of the full commission file be provided to both parties for any cases that go into investigation. That way, if there is evidence of crimes, that can be dealt with. If there is other violations, constitutional violations, those also can be dealt with. But it eases the post-conviction motion for appropriate relief process if we can benefit from the work that we're already paying for at the Innocence Inquiry Commission. The reporting structure. The commission, the Innocence Inquiry Commission, does not have a commission similar to the Indigent Defense Commission. It is that 8-member panel is there to look at the cases. It is not an administrative commission. And so when there's an administrative issue, the parties are having to go directly to the panel that is going to then be determining their case. That responsibility needs to be split. So our recommendation is that the administrative office, the courts, administer the office, and that the 8-member panel be limited to work on specific cases. And then one more step for maximizing efficiency. For 7 years, the Innocence Inquiry Commission and the Center on Actual Innocence exchanged case lists to ensure there was not duplication of efforts on cases, or if work had been done by one agency that might benefit the analysis of another agency, that information could be shared. In September of 2015, the Innocence Inquiry Commission voted not to share the lists anymore. Although it was working very well for 7 years, our recommendation is that practice be reestablished for efficiency's sakes, and if there is issues with the practice, that those be addressed without just completely discontinuing the process, again, for cost efficiency and efficiency of resources. Just as a note on that, when the Innocence Inquiry Commission legislation was drafted, the intent of the drafters was that the cases would be screened by the Innocence Projects. So the nonprofit or school agencies or organizations would screen the cases and identify the cases that had credible evidence. From this chart, you can see that 50% of the cases, they're not claiming innocence or there's no new evidence. So those cases could be screened out. It doesn't mean that the determinations couldn't be double-checked by the Innocence Inquiry Commission. If that is something they wanted to ensure that they were comfortable with the determinations, but a lot of the front work could be done by outside of a state agency. Other suggestions: change the name. There is confusion between the Center on Actual Innocence and the Innocence Inquiry Commission. To resolve that, we could revert back to the Criminal Case Review Commission, which is the name of the agency in the UK that we are modeled after. Require each co-defendant to have his or her case simultaneously investigated with the pending claim and only allow exceptions for good cause. If there's 5 co-defendants in a case, you really need access to everybody to have a full picture of the case. And in one case, we had 2 co-defendants go together in one hearing and 3 go to another hearing. That's a lot of resources that should be put to a one-time hearing. You either play or pass. And if you want to apply later, then you have to show why that was necessary. If a co-defendant goes forward and is exonerated, the other co-defendants would have access to that information and could use that for the traditional MAR process. I recommend reducing the number of judges in the final determination panel from 3 to 2. We started with 3 to build confidence in the process. I think confidence in the process is there. With 2 judges, if 2 judges are going to agree on something, it's hard to get 1 judge to agree. If you're going to get 2 to agree, you're going to have 3. So just limit the resources, reduce the expense by having just 2 judges at the hearings. And then the other recommendations are minor amendments to the rules of operation, the most important one of those being that there should be input into the rules of operation. Right now, the rules of operation are established in CROW's procedures, meetings, and there is no process for district attorneys or defense attorneys or defendants to give input into the rules of operation. Any good organization will have a process for feedback. This is just my closing as far as other suggestions for continuous improvement is reinstate the Joint Select Study Commission on the Preservation of Biological Evidence established in 2009. We need that study commission back badly. The evidence that can be used for biological testing is only growing, and we have to have a process for storing that evidence properly and getting rid of the evidence we don't need to keep. There are plenty of defendants who would pass on testing if they were given notice before destruction. I have been tracking destruction notices since 2006. The legislation was passed in 2001. I've been tracking destruction notices that have been filed since 2006. 88 counties have never filed a notice of destruction of biological evidence, ever. 74 of the 120 came from Mecklenburg County. So, I can guarantee you it's not because evidence is not being destroyed. It's because notice is not being given. And eventually, there will be a lawsuit. Modify 15268 to require notice prior to destruction of biological evidence in plea cases. We've had, I think, 7 plea cases in North Carolina that have resulted in exoneration. The same notice should be given to people who take pleas as someone who is convicted. That was a compromise piece of legislation that needs to be relooked. Resurrect the Jailhouse Informant Testimony Bill, H-700, for discussion. And modify 14882, the provision for compensation, to allow for compensation when charges are dismissed on the basis of innocence between the prosecutor, the defense, and the judge. Right now, if you go through the Innocence Inquiry Commission to a 3-judge panel and you're found innocent, you are automatically entitled to statutory compensation. If you go through an MAR and you're found innocent by a judge and the consent of a district attorney, you have to get a pardon of innocence from the governor before you're entitled to statutory compensation. That forces people who, in cases that could be resolved through traditional channels, to have to go to consider another channel because of what happens at the end. And if you have a finding of innocence by a judge or consent by a district attorney, then we should allow for compensation without the pardon process. And then continuing to recognize that the process, again, needs to be subject to continuous improvement.
Any questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you. The recommendations that you made today, have you presented them to the AOC or the conference or DAs or anything? Have they seen them prior to today?
Many of these recommendations have been presented and discussed and did not make it through the channels completely, so I'm presenting them to you for your consideration.
Any other questions? Any comments from the members? Don't forget our next meeting will be on February 3rd at 1 o'clock. This meeting is adjourned. Yeah.